Okay, we might kick off. Next session is risk margins. Have we come full circle? Which is a topic of interest to me, certainly, as I was involved in the original task force that put the framework paper together a few years ago, and the framework paper is referred to a number of times in the Winley and Chris's paper. Just a little bit of an introduction to the two speakers here. So Winley has worked as an actuarial consultant in London, New Zealand and Australia. She's presently with Taylor Fry Analytics and Consulting Actuaries, where she's worked since 2002. She advises on various aspects of commercial and personal lines pricing and accident compensation schemes. She's an appointed actuary to two international insurers, as well as a lead consultant to several long-tailed portfolios. She was inspired to write this paper when, deep into the night, having spent all day on a risk margin analysis with a multitude of correct answers, she started ranting, raving, and questioning, as one does, the merits of all the time spent on risk margins and whether all this work would really save the world. So the paper was born. Enjoy. Probably should read that one second. Chris has worked in general insurance and accident compensation since 1980, been a consulting actuary all that time, provides advice to insurers, reinsurers, accident compensation schemes. Advice has generally been in relation to premium setting, balance sheet reserving, capital and solvency management, scheme monitoring and cost of scheme changes. Been a member of various institute committees and task forces, including the GIPC, Professional Standards Committee, Code of Professional Conduct Task Force on the Introduction of FCR and General Insurance, Research Committee and the Institute Council. In 2010, he joined the board of the Institute of Safety, Compensation and Rehabilitation Research, SCRR, body jointly supported by Victorian WorkSafe, the Victorian Transport Accident Commission, and Monash University. He's also chairman of the Personal Injury Education Foundation.
Thank you, Carl. So risk margins, have we come full circle? First, I'll start with a little bit on what compelled Chris and I to write this paper. We feel that we, the actuarial profession, we've spent the best part of the last decade putting in considerable effort into more and more accurate risk margin estimation. Yet, after all this time, we seem no closer to common agreement of practice. There seems to be a variety of approaches still out there and a variety of outcomes, all of which are potentially correct. So why is this? Why, after all this time, all this effort, are we seemingly stuck in middle ground? Well, this is the crux of our paper. Our contention is that being stuck in middle ground is no good for anyone. Not good for the industry, not good for society, who put faith in our analyses for insurer security and solvency. So we think it's timely for the profession to stand back from the detail, take stock, and maybe make a level shift in the way we think about risk. Are we making progress? Ask ourselves. Are we adding value? It's time to kick us off middle ground, we think. Instead of increasing complexity, we ask ourselves, have we now sufficient understanding of the uncertainties, of the multitudes of areas of judgment, of the subjectivities, all the practical hurdles and issues, to now support a simpler approach? So risk margins, have we come full circle? Let's get going. Okay. We'll start with a brief history of risk margins, and the reason for that is just to put into context where we are with risk margins today and to put context into the discussion that we're going to have. We'll then look at a survey of the current approaches in use. So are we right in saying that there are a range of approaches, or has everyone got consensus? So the only way to do that, ask a few people. Then we'll talk about the practical considerations and the hurdles to achieving consensus. And then we'll provide an example, if there is time, showing how the multitude of judgments, subjectivities, all along the process can impact outcomes. You know, what level of impact can it have? And finally, as we are the first people to start throwing stones and poking holes, it's fair that we try to put forward our own solution for where to next. And we encourage and welcome all of you to poke holes in this. And the happy part is that Chris will be the person standing up here at that time. Okay. A little history. I'm going to do a quick whiz through the last 30 years in 30 seconds. So here we go. Long before we had explicit risk margins, actuaries worldwide used to allow for implicit margins through allowing for conservative assumptions when they were determining their insurance liabilities. Throughout the 90s, there were numerous methods developed for explicit risk margins. They were derived from utility theory, ruin theory, then a heavier focus on the second moments of estimates and so on. And then from the early 2000s, this evolved into several distinct approaches, and we cover two in our paper, being the percentile method that's used in Australia. And then there's also the cost of capital method, which is the one preferred in the European countries. And that is the basis of solvency too. So we won't talk about it here, but feel free to read the paper. The percentile method became entrenched in Australia in 2002. That's when APRA prescribed explicit minimum margins to be included in the insurance provision. And the percentile method, I suppose, became entrenched because it fits better with this 75% probability of sufficiency requirement. What about accounting requirements? Well, it was in 2004 that AASB 1023 first prescribed explicit margins. Before that, there was no mention of any margins. And that was when the standards were revised in this country to align with international financial reporting standards. It's different to APRA's requirements. There's more flexibility. There's no specification of any level of sufficiency or explicit margin that's required. You just have to disclose what you're doing. Tax. In Australia, there is tax deductibility on the risk margins, I mean, by way of their inclusion in the outstanding claims liability. And this tax position probably assisted with Australian insurers' acceptance of the risk margin being included in the accounting and regulatory requirements. Next page. Okay, moving on to actuarial developments. I mean, there are a lot of key dates, but these are the ones I've picked, right? So we start with 2001, the Tillinghurst benchmark paper that was commissioned by the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. I mention this as the first date because this paper is still very much quoted today, is still very much in use and relied upon, particularly by small to medium-sized insurers. Then in 2005, the Institute of Actuaries, you know, started taking this very seriously. They started a risk margins task force. And two of the key roles, there were other key roles as well, but two of those included moving the profession away from reliance on benchmarks and two, encouraging some consistency of approach between all the practitioners. In 2006, they carried out a survey of industry practice, and this showed a lack of agreement in just about every aspect, you know, correlations, the distributions used, all the different areas of subjectivity. I mean, the only thing that everyone agreed on was the use of the percentile approach, because I guess we had to. Then in 2008, the Risk Margins Task Force produced a very comprehensive framework for assessment of risk margins. So now I'm going to fast forward 4 years to today, 2002. What is happening now? Do we have consensus? Are we moving towards consensus? Like a typical actuary, we did a survey to answer that question. We did a quick and simple survey of 30 portfolios. I won't claim that this is by any means a reflection of the entire industry. We basically asked a few people we know so that we have 30 portfolios with different characteristics, basically. We've got small, medium, large, long tail, short tail. So we defined small, the half of them was small, as those with net central estimates of their insurance liability of less than $50 million. And large are those with more than $200 million. So medium is something in between. We had short tail, long tail, and a mix. We asked them some very simple questions like, what techniques, approaches do you use for your risk margin determination? What is the size of your risk margin? First of all, as a percentage of your central estimate. And then if we think of risk margins as really forming a part of capital, then what is its significance, you know, compared to your eligible capital, your net assets, your MCR, is it large? I mean, does anyone know? So we thought that would be interesting to know, to see how much effort we should put into this exercise. And then we asked things like, you know, how long does it take you to do your risk margin estimation? Is it a substantial exercise? Is it a couple of hours? And how often do you update it? 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? So our paper sets out the outcomes in more detail, but I'll just give you a brief summary of some of the interesting things. In terms of the techniques used, we had a fair mix. There were people who used purely benchmarks from 2001, from the Trowbridge or Tillinghast papers. Some people used bootstraps and in combination with other stochastic methods. There was also a random walk simulation. I wasn't quite sure what that entailed. There was stochastic analyses of historical loss ratios. There was use of the scorecards for the internal systemic risks. And there were subjective allowances, particularly for the external systemic risks. What I was quite surprised to find was that for the small to medium-sized portfolios, so we're talking about the ones under $200 million that we surveyed, 40% of those still adopt the benchmarks from a decade ago, purely, without any other analyses. For the large portfolios, all adopt some form of stochastic method, but they do make subjective allowances. I don't have the precise details, but basically to allow for market and individual characteristics. People also provided a number of comments on judgment and subjectivity being applied, particularly for the systemic elements, and also that the assumptions for their scorecards used were relatively crude. So I'm just quoting a couple of comments. Okay, size. What is the size as a percentage of central estimates? The risk margins at the 75 probability of sufficiency averaged about 18% of net central estimates overall. Unsurprisingly, it was bigger for the small, it's larger for the small, and the margins were smaller, 11% for the large portfolios. I mean, it's not surprising because the large portfolios would generally sort of enjoy greater diversification benefits, and also they will have a lower independent risk on the whole. And then again, lower for short tail and higher for long tail with the great uncertainty. So that, no surprises there. The next slide, I think, to me anyway, is the interesting bit. If we think of risk margins as a part of capital, how significant is it as a proportion of eligible capital, as a proportion of net assets? Well, the answer is a wide range. If you look at these graphs, the first graph shows you the risk margins as a percentage of net assets. Each point is one insurer. So the higher it is, I mean, there is a bit of an outlier there, 96%. I don't know who that was. But on the whole, they range between 1% to 20%, averaging about 19% if you count the outlier. And for less than 10%, for 40% of the respondents, their risk margins as a percentage of their eligible capital was less than 10%. So for 40% of the people surveyed, it wasn't such a big deal. We looked also at risk margins as a percentage of the MCR, APRA minimum capital requirement. Again, the answer is a wide range. How long time taken? How long does it take people to do these things? How often do they revise it? Unsurprisingly, it's minimal, a few hours for benchmarks, to around 7 days for the people who adopt a significant part of the framework, and that's for the larger portfolios. How often do they revise it? Just under two-thirds of people do it every year, and the rest do it 2-3 years plus. Okay, so what are the main takeouts from the survey? We have four. One, there's still a heavy reliance on benchmarks. That's particularly for the small and medium-sized insurers. Two, there's still limited consensus of practice. I mean, in fact, we did ask respondents an extra question. Do you have any intention in the immediate or near future to change the way you're doing things? The answer was no by all of them. So it's not like we're making any changes towards anything. The third thing, there's still a heavy reliance on subjectivity, judgment, particularly for the systemic risks. And in terms of the significance of the risk margin as a proportion of capital, that is very varied across the different insurers, as we've seen, from 1% up to 91%. So at face value, anyway, the risk margins task force key roles of moving the profession away from reliance on benchmarks and towards a consensus approach has seemingly not been achieved. So why? I mean, I would say that as actuaries, none of us, all of us, are not afraid of complexity. By our very nature and training, we love the challenge of a complex task and method and challenge. So why is there so little excitement about following the full framework? Why is there so little desire for a sophisticated consensus approach? Why are we so reliant on benchmarks? So the question I ask is, what's the problem? Well, some answers are provided, we think, in the Risk Margin Task Force's paper itself. I want to add, first of all, that there is no doubt that that paper helped many actuaries, myself included, to clearly categorise the various sources of risk and to set out all the various subjectivities involved in various steps of the process. And I thought that was really excellent. But what the paper also highlighted was that the full-scale risk margin determination is a substantial exercise. And there's a lot of subjectivity involved in many, many, many steps of the process. So I've pulled these phrases, sort of pulled them out of the task force's paper, significant amount of judgment, a large degree of judgment. So these are various steps of the process where they qualify it with, this bit is a blend of art and science. There's a substantial amount of judgment, qualitative judgment, art in itself. I'm running out of adjectives to talk about judgments, you know. How many more types of level and degrees of judgments can we have? So I did a quick word count, and there's a reasonably short document, there's about 40 words, judgment, subjectivity, art in itself. So you have to ask yourself, if you went through this whole process where you made all these subjective judgments, would it inspire your confidence in the outcome? I mean, even with documenting them all, every single one of them, with the amount of subjectivity involved in each selection, it's not hard to see how quickly we soon lose all transparency and the big picture is obscured. So other hurdles to consensus that we gleaned from our research and discussions with actuaries, including ourselves, and also some entities, include this. These are the main hurdles we picked up, which is weighing up of cost and effort. A lot of people said that the practical difficulties and all the subjectivities involved lead them to question whether the effort involved is worth the possible increase in accuracy. In fact, some insurers, entities said to us that they saw this detailed analysis of risk margins as more disruptive to their financial reporting than adding value. Ouch! You know, don't we all want to add value? In fact, one thing that David Hart said to me, and I said, oh, you've been here so many years, what's the main message you carry through? He said, oh, the main thing we said in that first conference in 78 or whatever in Threadboys, we always have to add value. We always have to add value, you know. The second thing was they saw no marked improvement in transparency. We've already covered that. The next thing is the significance of the margin, or shall I say insignificance of the margin in capital terms, not for all insurers, for some insurers. And for those insurers, for between 1% to 10%, you know, it's hard to justify the efforts on this this aspect of the whole capital calculation. There was limited availability of internal data. The data was volatile. These comments particularly from people who are from smaller insurers. And for them, they said it was just more cost-effective to rely on benchmarks. A substantial amount of actuarial judgment, I've covered that. And finally, a footnote for higher quantiles. So that's higher probability of sufficiencies. At sort of 90% plus probability of sufficiency, we're talking, say, 99% for runoffs or capital transfers. The practical issues are magnified. And what we've seen from some of the academic studies, which are quite, you know, from reputable people like Eckhart, coming out of Aston recently, I think it was just October, a month ago, was that the outcomes at these high quantiles are so extremely unreliable as to be of dubious value. So why are we still using them? That's the question. My last slide before I pass on to Chris. In the paper itself, I won't cover the details here, we also provide an example. I would call it a bit of a cheeky example to show the impact of judgment, of subjectivity can have on the outcomes, risk margin outcomes. We looked at a multinational, multi-line insurer, and we showed how the risk margin, which we calculated at 22%, could be halved to 11% by some not unreasonable judgments on systemic risks and correlations that Chris and I made up. And we could halve it again. In fact, we could correlate the whole thing away. I mean, it's an exaggerated and a simple example, and it is a bit cheeky, but we did it to illustrate a point. So now I've done the easy part of the talk, which is just to criticize everything that everyone does. I feel a little bit like the leader of the opposition. But so articulate all the problems. So easy. So at some point, we have to provide some answers. So if increasing complexity to us is not the answer to achieving consensus, then where to next? Happily, at this point, I pass on to Chris Latham.
Thanks, Wynne. Well, Wynne has sort of taken us through a history of the development of risk margins over the last 20-odd years and the struggles we've had with them. Well, as she said, where do we go to from here? What's it all mean? What are we going to do? So I'm going to finish off with a few suggestions we've got for you to think about. So try and keep an open mind. And I've got to try and change this. Yes. Okay, now if risk margins, if margins are loading on central estimates, then they're part of capital. APRA obviously thinks in this way because when they talk about their MCR as providing a 0.5% probability of ruin when you include the risk margin. So they think in that way. And Wynne has talked about the proportion of the total capital that's represented by risk margins. So why should we hold them in the balance sheet provision and not below the line like the rest of the capital? There's no theoretically sound reason why we should. So why do we? I mean, we do it, so why do we? And I've thought of a few reasons and say a few words about them. One is, well, because we always have, but that's not true. Wynne has shown that explicit risk margins only really came in with APRA in 2002, and before that, 1023 did not mention risk margins, but they followed suit with APRA and included risk margins in 1023. So that's not a very long time. So even if it were true, it's not a very good reason. So that's that reason. Secondly, because it's tax deductible, yeah, well, that's true, but I hardly find that a compelling reason theoretically. It's nothing to do with the main game of trying to ensure policyholder security, and I don't really think the tax office has thought much about it. I don't think that they've said, well, we want to encourage desirable behaviour, so let's make the risk margin tax deductible. I think it's just something that happened. The balance sheet provision is tax deductible. That's sort of it. Third reason, because it gives insurers the opportunity to smooth profits. Well, if this is a reason, I don't think it works terribly well because insurers don't tend to change their probabilities of sufficiency terribly often, and it's frowned upon by the tax man who thinks they're just trying to fiddle their tax bill for the year, so they don't want to start up go down that track. And it's supposed to concern the auditors as well, and the auditors are meant to provide a true and fair view of the profit, and they're supposed to not like that as well. Fourthly, because the capital requirements as provided by the regulator are seen to be insufficient. Certainly this was the case in previous capital regimes. Those people who have been around long enough would remember that initially in terms of when I started, the capital requirement was, I think, 15% of premium, and that's it. And then it when National Employers Mutual, who was in runoff in Australia, went belly up and they didn't have to hold any capital because they didn't have any premium, they said, OK, well, we better include outstanding claims in the capital requirement. But once again, they were very crude and all-encompassing percentages of premiums and outstanding claims. And so at that time, you could have said the capital requirement regime is flawed, so it's not adequate. Let's put in a risk margin to make it a little bit better. However, that's not true these days. I mean, we have a very comprehensive risk-based capital requirement regime, which is, I think, it holds up very well by international standards. It's good. So really, in the current environment, I just don't see any compelling reasons for risk margins. I do hasten to add, though, that I'm talking about ongoing regulatory and financial reporting. I'm not talking about situations where there are transfers of portfolios, mergers, acquisitions, where money is actually changing hands. I mean, the situation's quite different there. And these are special situations and there are special factors that come into this, and any sort of regulatory margin would be just a starting point. But the risk margins certainly have a role to play in mergers and acquisitions and where money is changing hands, so that's accepted. But all that work could be done at the time. These things, they come up relatively rarely. So if we decided to get rid of risk margins, who would be upset? What would APRA think? This is sort of like the Gruen transfer, you know, where they say, what would Putin or Palmer think? But what would APRA think? Well, I don't think APRA would bother too much about it because it fits in with their view of the world anyway. They're concerned with capital requirements more mainly. Auditors. Well, they're concerned with the reporting of profits, as I said, true and fair view. Reporting on central estimates would seem to satisfy the aim of a true and fair view. You could at least make an argument for that. Indeed, when the new version of 1023 came out in 2004 and they included a risk margin, the academic accountants mounted an argument of saying we should just use central estimates. This is the best estimate of a true and fair view of profit. But the practitioner accountants didn't like that, and so it ended up they did put in something for a risk margin. But to be honest, I've rarely heard an auditor clearly articulate the reason for risk margins. Many years ago, when the insurance environment was pretty tough and actuaries were tending to understate, I do remember one prominent auditor noting that and saying, well, because actuaries always understate and even nominated how much we understate by 10%, then we should have risk margins of about 10% because we know that actuaries always get it understate. Of course, in more recent years, that's not been the case. We've tended to overstate. So, I mean, I don't think that is a very, very well-articulated case for putting in risk margins. But I do also worry about this true and fair view idea where there is uncertainty. While we might think that central estimates satisfy this, I'm not really sure what auditors think about it. Where there is uncertainty about the level of profit, is it best to have a margin in there until you're more certain what the profit's going to be? Of course, then the question becomes, how certain do you want to be? We might even move to Lloyd's accounting and wait for 3 years before we release any profit or take up any loss, as it turns out. As I said, I've never heard auditors discuss this or explain their position in a way where we can respond and say, oh, if that's what your problem is, this is what we can do with the balance sheet provision. And I do think that's a discussion we should have. What would we think about it? Well, it would relieve us of the burden and the agony that we go through in estimating risk margins. The appointed actuaries in the larger insurers would still have to worry about estimating the appropriate capital for their organisations, but we go from having two lots of things to agonise over, being risk margins and capital, to only having one thing to agonise over, being the capital requirements. So that's got to be an improvement. But I don't mean that all of the terrific work that some of our members have done over the last 10 years on risk margins is going to be wasted. It's just that I think that, and the framework that we currently use can be applied in a different context, and that is in the context of estimating the appropriate amount of capital. It doesn't have to be specific to necessarily to risk margins. And there'll still need to be risk margins, as I said, for mergers and acquisitions and things. And then there, of course, there are the insurers. Private sector insurers, I think, probably won't be too happy about releasing the margin into profit because they'll lose control over that amount. If it's released into profit, they might have to actually pay it in dividends, or it just changes the nature of it all. And in truth, I mean, I do think that insurers do like to manage their profits. They set up expectations for their shareholders and analysts, and they try to achieve these expectations, probably not unreasonably. But the extent to which they can manage their profit, it may be limited, but they still certainly try and do it, in my experience. And without risk margins, if we do abolish risk margins, it might lead to pressure being put on the AAs to vary their central estimates one way or another, depending on the circumstances. But this isn't new. I mean, we've lived with this ever since we started working in general insurance. So it's whether we have risk margins in the provision or not, we still come under pressure from the management to fit in with their expectations. On the other side of the coin, the public sector insurers would be delighted, absolutely delighted. With most of them operating under government guarantees, they see little need for a risk margin. I mean, in truth be known, they shouldn't have to report under 1023, but we won't go there. And the considerations regarding capital are quite different for public sector insurers, and that's a subject that's been talked about at length at accident comp seminars in the past. Just as an example of what happened to me a few years ago, when the current framework for risk margins emerged, I had the joy of communicating to an accident comp scheme that their risk margin was going to be increased by about 3 percentage points, only about $200 million. Nothing to do with claims experience, nothing to do with operational issues, nothing they could do anything at all about. It was just actuaries changing their mind on a technical issue. And it didn't do much for my reputation or the reputation of actuaries that this was done. Okay, well, that's what I've thrown up for discussion as to, I guess it's what I would like to see happen, but it's not going to happen, is it? It's just probably too hard. We just don't live in a sensible and rational world. But what might we be able to do that keeps everybody happy or doesn't upset too many people? I still think that APRA could easily change their capital requirements to incorporate the risk margin into their overall capital requirements. This should be pretty straightforward. It's just be another evolution of the capital requirements, and APRA is changing them all the time. So they incorporate it into that, don't need a risk margin. But what are we going to do about financial reporting? God. 1023 requires a risk margin, as we've said. It's not a specific probability of sufficiency like APRA reporting, but it does say, quote, risk margins adopting for regulatory purposes may be appropriate, blah, 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 or an appropriate starting point. And that's not much good if APRA doesn't have any risk margins, so I guess they need some help. This is where I guess some people might argue, well, if APRA and financial reporting are so different, we've got two sets of accounts, haven't we? And that's not good. I mean, we really like to have a uniform set of accounts, and I know that that's a bogeyman to most people. But really, and are we exacerbating that by having risk margins for financial reporting but not for regulatory reporting? Well, I mean, if you look at the financial reporting and APRA reporting, there are many differences already. Obviously, we've got different probabilities of sufficiency in the existing risk margins. You've got premium liabilities versus a LAT, a different approach. And as far as the LAT is concerned, we have different approaches to setting the risk margin that is used for LAT purposes than we do for premium liabilities for APRA purposes. And we have different probabilities of sufficiency for the outstanding claims compared to the premium liabilities. It beats me. I don't know how the logic of that, but it probably shows up the practical approach to accounting risk margins. And then there's a question of discount rates. APRA says government bonds. 1023 says risk-free rates. I used to think they were the same, or that they were considered to be the same, but wiser people than me have said, no, that's not the case. So it would be possible to actually to use different discount rates for APRA reporting and financial reporting. So really, we've got quite a few differences anyway. So what we're suggesting here doesn't really exacerbate it too much. So if we can't convince the accountants to change their accounting standard, what are we going to, we're going to have to come up with an alternative. Now, just for the sake of continuity, we could have some risk margins. I know, let's do industry benchmarks. Back to the future. But honestly, it's hard for me to get excited about risk margins when they're there, risk margins for financial reporting, when they're only there to satisfy some vague accounting standard that the accountants don't really know why it's there, and to get a tax deduction. I find it hard to get excited and to go to a lot of time and trouble to try and satisfy something that is quite ill-defined. So we could publish benchmarks at various probabilities of sufficiency varying by size, a la Bate-Upreid, and do it every few years. So I admit that some thought might need to be given to diversification and the effect of reinsurance to give some semblance of appropriateness of your own specific risk margin. But in the case of reinsurance, when I think about it, it's only APRA that seems concerned about gross and net risk margins. I've not heard any auditors propound or say anything about the technical aspects of gross and net risk margins. So if we could do that part of it, if we could do that much, get rid of risk margins for regulatory reporting and maybe do benchmarks for financial reporting, we'd have greater transparency. We'd have no loss of security for policyholders, which is what I say is the main game. We'd have much easier ILVRs and EPRs, and there'd be less agony for us. So in that, I say speed the day. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. We've got a couple of minutes for questions. Before we open the floor for questions, just a reminder to do your feedback in the usual way. So any questions? Here we go. Krista? If you can just state your name and company, please.
Krista Marchbanks, PwC. Earlier this year, APRA did a study of the risk management section, FCRs, and gave the industry some feedback about the lack of consistency and the content of those sections. I don't know if there's anybody here from APRA, but has there ever been consideration of a similar sort of study, if you like, on the risk margin section of ILVRs, given the feedback that Wynne and Chris have given on their sort of limited sample survey? Or...
Kate Bible from APRA. I was hoping Rob Thompson was in the room so I could fob it off on him. We had the similar question recently about updating the report that we did 5 or 6 years ago. Certainly considering it, updating it. We're also thinking about what we can publish from what we got on the gross and net risk margins and diversification. But obviously we have a lot of stuff on and it's a matter of prioritising it. But I'm getting that sense from a number of people that that's something that you're interested in. We obviously have a lot of data. We just have to be wary of what conclusions we make versus that becoming a new benchmark. So I'll certainly take it away and raise it to be considered.
One more question. At the back.
Hi, Joseph Valenti, BT. I can imagine, like, years and years ago, a caveman trying to start a fire with a flint and taking a lot of time and frustration. If you gave it away then, where would we be? And as a profession, if we just throw things in the too hard basket because they cause frustration, where does that get us in the future?
I think that's a false analogy, talking about a flint. I mean, I don't. We're talking about man-made complexity here for no purpose. I mean, using a flint and lighting a fire did serve some purpose, but I have yet to have explained to me what the why we need to have risk margins. I mean, I could easily be missing something, but if we just put them in because we can do them, even if we could do them really well, why do we just put them in? Because we're really good at it? This is not a good reason.
Clive Amory, AM Actuaries. Chris, I wholeheartedly agree with you. A lot of sense you make today. Have you actually taken it further and floated the idea past APRA to get their reaction to
my
it?
My question.
No, I only thought of it a few weeks ago when Lee and I started talking about it.
We'll let APRA have the last word.
Well, I think about it a long time ago, but then I sort of gave up. But now I'm excited about it again.
I think you might have technically now floated the idea with that, right? Well, we haven't reviewed the capital requirements for a while, so I can't see why we couldn't do it. Some interesting thoughts that you raised, and I personally haven't thought at all about giving up on the risk margins, and I'll say it like that, giving up on them. Clearly, we've just finished a major review of our capital requirements and you're not going to see us dropping risk margins in the next little while, but I'm happy to add it to my list of things to do.
Well, look, APRA has led us, the profession. APRA took the lead by putting risk margins in the first place. The accounting profession followed. I would think that if APRA took a lead on this, you may find the accountants fall in behind us, or behind you.
Okay, on that note, I think we might wrap up and again thank Winley and Chris for their presentation.